25. 30 minutes later, the clearing beneath Skull Gullet Cave was full of wizards. They had called every wizard in Europe except Jimmy and Eddie, a.k.a. Wing Po. They'd excluded Jimmy for obvious reasons. They had no direct evidence that Eddie was involved, but they had no evidence that he wasn't either, and they chose not to risk telling him. They kept it quiet by telling everyone they were planning a surprise for Jimmy, which Philip pointed out with palpable glee was true. Skull Gullet Cave was chosen for the meeting because it was large enough to accommodate everyone, and the mouth of the skull made a fine amphitheater. Philip stood in front, because he was the most well-known and respected wizard present, next to Gwen, to explain that she was a wizard and to tell what she had found in Rikard's Bend, Tyler, to explain about Rikard's Bend and to tell about his ghosting, and Gary, because he insisted, and it was his cave. As the wizard started arriving, Martin found a quiet moment to speak with Gwen privately. He leaned in close.
Gwen, can I ask you a question?
Gwen tensed, but said,
Yes.
Martin bit his lip, then asked,
In your salutation, how did you throw that lummox off of you like that? That was really, really cool. I considered trying to do something like that in mine, but I couldn't figure out an elegant way to program it. You'd have to differentiate between you, your belongings, and the person you want to repel. I just can't figure out how you did it.
Gwen smiled and actually laughed a bit.
It's actually really simple. You know the exclusion zones we use to seal off certain places? They only act on people, and you can make them not apply to yourself, right? Well, I make a cone-shaped exclusion zone underground beneath my feet. Then I make it move up over my head really fast, and any person who isn't me but is standing inside the radius of the cone gets thrown off.
Martin stared at her, mouth agape. She thought he was amazed, and that was part of it. He was also tremendously turned on.
Wow, he said. That's so simple. It just never occurred to me. Really, nice work.
He couldn't think of anything else to do, so he shook her hand. He started to walk away, then turned back to face her.
Can I ask you another question?
Sure,
she said.
What year are you from?
She laughed again.
2014. Born in 92.
Martin smiled.
Huh. So I'm a little older than you.
She shook her head.
I've been here for 10 years, so technically I'm older than you. I was just born later.
Martin smiled again.
Huh. That's right, isn't it? Cool.
He turned and walked down to the clearing. Glenn watched him go. Martin and Jeff stood in the clearing with the rest of the wizards. Philip thanked everyone for coming, apologized for the false pretenses, and promised them that they'd all understand why it was necessary soon enough. He started by announcing that Gwen was a wizard.
I told all of you that I was the first one to show up in this time and place, but that's not quite true. Gwen, whom you all know, since she made all of your robes, had already been here for a month when I showed up. She swore me and Jimmy to secrecy because a female wizard is called a witch, and the locals have something of an attitude about witches.
Heads nodded in agreement. One voice at the back said something about her weighing the same as a duck, but nobody was in the mood. Philip opened the floor for questions about Gwen's wizardiness before moving on to business. Most of the questions centered on her tailoring business. She explained that she took measurements and made patterns the old-fashioned way, but went to the future to buy fabric. Also, on harder sewing jobs, she'd use a sewing machine. She had the powers of a wizard, the standing in the community of a craftsman, and the freedom to walk the streets without people asking her to magic their problems away. It was all quite lovely, until Rikard's Bend. Her description of what she found there sucked all of the air out of the room. She told the story of how she had brought Martin, Jeff, and Gary out to have a look, and she explained that she'd had to break her cover to get them away from Kluge's gang. She concluded by saying that it was clear to them that the villagers were killed by a wizard, and that the wizard had embarked on a secret plan to make hobbits. This comment produced several raised hands. Gwen called on one of the Norwegian death metal wizards. He stammered, stalling a bit.
Sorry, but I have to ask... Philip, what have you been doing upstairs in your shop?
Philip bit his lip. Gary announced,
We already checked on that.
He's been transporting and assembling a car, one piece at a time. Most of the hands went down. Philip made eye contact with Martin, who could only shrug. Gary continued.
It's a Pontiac Fiero.
The rest of the hands went down. The wizards from Italy tried to hide their amusement, but not very hard. Philip explained briefly that the others had come to him and that during that conversation they figured out what had happened to Tyler. Philip turned the floor over to Tyler, who just barely managed to keep his composure as he told the assembled wizards how he learned Jimmy's plan and was ghosted for it. That was all it took. By the time he was done, everyone present was of a like mind. There was some discussion, but the consensus was that Jimmy had violated the only three rules they had. He had altered people's physical structure, he had done so on helpless locals who had not given their consent, and he had used his power to ghost Tyler, which everyone agreed was unspeakably cruel without really having to discuss it. Philip summed up.
So, we know what was done, and we know by whom. We can't let this stand. If we don't stop him, we're just as responsible as he is. We have to go to London, confront Jimmy, and put an end to this once and for all. We must police ourselves, because no one else can. We'll give him an opportunity to explain himself. I doubt he'll have a valid excuse, because I can't imagine what a valid excuse would be. More likely, he'll try to fight us, but he can't possibly ghost everyone. And if he manages to get a few of us, the rest can neutralize him and undo the damage. It's not going to be easy,
Philip continued.
Many of you like Jimmy, and it's going to be hard for you to take him down. I despise him, and as such, I will have a hard time pretending not to enjoy every second of his downfall and humiliation. That's my burden to bear.
The sun was high in the sky, and in the splendid courtyard in front of the Golden Palace of Camelot, people were going about their daily business. Workmen worked, guards guarded, and everyone was squinting, as was their custom on a sunny day. The light reflecting off of the Golden Castle Camelot, the giant gold-covered gates, the massive golden statue of the old king, the young king, and the wizard who advised them, and the polished gold adornments on the staff's uniforms combined to give the impression that to be at Camelot Castle was to stand in the center of the sun. People's vision was so impaired by the unceasing glare that most of them didn't even notice when 23 wizards, wearing sunglasses, suddenly appeared out of nowhere, linked hand to shoulder like a sideways conga line. The wizards separated themselves from one another and strode purposefully to the castle's entrance, Philip and Tyler in the lead, flanked by Martin, Gwen, Gary, and Jeff. Martin asked Philip,
"So, what's the plan?"
"I'm gonna win," Philip said. "I'm finally gonna beat him, and I'm gonna taste his defeat. Then I'm gonna chew his defeat. Then I'm gonna open my mouth wide and make him look at his gross chewed-up defeat, and he will be disgusted by it, as I am by him."
"Damn right," Tyler added, "and I think I might kick him in the nuts."
Martin considered this and said,
"Good. I'm glad we have a solid plan."
The castle had no door, as such. The massive open archway led to the opulent antechamber, which in turn led to the great hall. Guards in gold-encrusted uniforms flanked the gold-encrusted arch, defending it with gold-encrusted swords. The guards made no move to prevent the wizards from entering. Philip sneered at them as he walked through the arch and ran face first into the invisible field that kept any wizard from entering the castle without Jimmy's permission. Tyler, Martin, and Gwen also walked into the field. The other wizards walked into them or each other. Over the sound of grumbling and cursing, one of the guards said,
"Merlin is expecting you. Please wait here and you'll be escorted to his chambers."
The wizards spread out, straightening their robes and regaining their dignity as best they could. After a moment, Eddie appeared in the antechamber.
"Gentlemen! Gwen! Welcome to Castle Camelot! Do come in!"
His lack of surprise at seeing Gwen carrying a wand was telling. Martin looked at Gwen askance.
"Eddie knew about you?"
he asked. Gwen was at a loss.
"I didn't tell him."
Eddie had sharp ears. He smiled and said,
Merlin tells me everything.
Tyler asked,
Oh, does he?
About twice as loud as he probably intended, Philip put a steadying hand on Tyler's shoulder. In a dry tone, Philip asked,
Did he tell you that he killed an entire village full of people?
Eddie's smile faded. He looked confused. Then his expression soured, and he mumbled,
Oh, Philip.
He composed himself, then with forced joviality said,
Merlin will be ready to see you all in a moment. Please, follow me.
The wizard spent the next 10 minutes exploring the most opulent waiting room in all of England. The seats were veritable thrones. Instead of magazines, there were tomes of arcane knowledge, which Martin recognized as books of magic tricks from the early 20th century. Some of them were in English, featuring men in tuxedos holding playing cards and pigeons. Others were in Chinese, and featured men in silk robes holding chrome rings and pigeons. It occurred to Martin that one way or the other, stage magic was the art of manipulating the pigeons. He considered sharing this idea with the other wizards, but he knew nobody was in the mood. While they waited, Eddie sat at a large desk in the corner. When they first arrived, he told the wizards to make themselves comfortable. Then, Eddie held up his right hand to use the magic handphone to make a call, but put his left hand up to his ear as if to press an earpiece. Merlin's flaming M icon appeared in his hand, and Eddie said that the wizards had arrived. Nobody heard the reply. Then Eddie said in a worried tone that they had said something about killing a village. More silence followed, but Eddie seemed reassured. He ended the call and told the assembled wizards that it would only be a few minutes. After a minute or two, he tried to engage Gary in conversation, but Gary asked him if he was proud to be the world's first receptionist, and with that, Eddie picked up on the ugly mood in the room and stopped talking. 10 minutes later, the large, ornately carved golden doors opened, and Jimmy invited everyone into his office. The wizards angrily stormed into Jimmy's office, but as the door was only wide enough to accommodate 2 wizards at a time, storming in angrily was almost indistinguishable from filing in politely. Although nobody had mentioned it, everyone was waiting to see Jimmy's reaction to Tyler. Everyone expected a satisfying mix of shock and guilt. Everyone was disappointed. Jimmy saw Tyler and took on the attitude of a man who has just bumped into an old friend who he knows has been in the hospital.
Tyler,
he said,
I'm so glad to see they finally brought you back.
He looked to Gary and Jeff and rolled his eyes dismissively.
I always knew they'd get the hint eventually, but I had no idea it'd take them so long. If it had gone on too much longer, I was going to step in and rescue you myself.
Tyler kicked Jimmy in the crotch as hard as he could. The speed and ferocity of it made every man in the room cringe. Every man but Jimmy, who mentioned that he had anticipated this eventuality and had created an exclusionary zone 1 foot in diameter around his genitalia. He explained that no one could get anywhere near that part of his body without his permission. He arched an eyebrow at Gwen. He had to speak up to explain all this over the sound of Tyler grunting with exertion as he fruitlessly kicked Jimmy's nether region over and over again. Finally, after several more kicks, Tyler stopped. Clearly, Jimmy's words had finally sunk in.
Satisfied? Jimmy asked.
Tyler kicked him in the shin. Jimmy grimaced in pain, hunched his shoulders, and hopped as he rubbed his bruised shin with his hands.
For now, said Tyler.
Jimmy's office was about the size of a tennis court. It had marble floors, gold leaf columns, a high ceiling painted to look like the sky, and large stained glass windows, the standard Jimmy design scheme. In one corner there was a desk, a predictably oversized gold rectangle of hardwood so covered with tiny ornate carvings that from a distance it read as a bumpy popcorn ceiling texture. In another corner there was an equally ornate altar. Clearly, this was where Jimmy stood to do magic in the presence of non-wizards. Martin wondered which of these 2 pieces of furniture hid Jimmy's computer. In the middle of the room, there was a large conference table. There was something acutely bumpy in the middle of the table, covered with a sheet that covered the table's entire surface and hung over the sides. Jimmy tried to do his customary glide step over to the conference table, but his newly acquired limp spoiled the effect.
"Gentlemen, Gwen," he said, "I understand that you're all upset. I don't blame you one bit, particularly you, Tyler. I haven't been honest, and I've done more than one thing of which I'm not proud. Mistakes were made, grave mistakes. But I'm confident that when you see why I did it, you'll understand. Please, gather round."
The wizards approached the table. Everyone, even Philip, had intended to give Jimmy the chance to explain. Nobody expected him to be able to justify his actions, but he was entitled to try. Eddie nosed his way through the group to stand next to his best friend and boss.
"As you all know," Jimmy said, "when I first arrived in this time and place, I found primitive conditions and ignorant, superstitious people."
"And me and Gwen," Philip added.
"Quite," Jimmy agreed. "And may I say, Gwen, I'm delighted that you finally decided to come out in the open and join the rest of us. Anyway, back when it was just the three of us, we made a sincere effort to keep from exposing the native people of this time to our modern ideas and conveniences. Philip, would you like to tell them how well that worked?"
"They all know that we discovered contamination from time travelers who had gone back even farther than us,"
Philip fumed,
"and that our actions weren't affecting the future. So what?"
Jimmy smiled benevolently.
"So, I decided there was no reason I shouldn't make life better here for everyone. I developed a three-phase plan. Phase one was to introduce little niceties like eating off of plates with forks instead of eating with daggers and stale slabs of bread. I introduced basic sanitation. I was careful to do this in such a way that the natives thought they were inventing it themselves. The castle we're standing in was phase two. I've stabilized the government, raised the kingdom's standard of living, and given the people leaders they can look to with pride."
Jimmy looked intolerably pleased with himself. Eddie also looked intolerably pleased with him. Jimmy continued.
"I had hoped to put off going public with the final phase of the plan, but I'm afraid Tyler forced my hand, which is fine. It's really no problem. I apologize for ghosting you, Tyler, but I had no choice. I still had a couple of details to shore up before I could unveil phase three. Phase three is designed to give the people the life they always wanted instead of the life they always get. When life gets hard, too hard to face, people often turn to movies, television, or books. We retreat into a world of fantasy. I am going to improve life for every sentient being on Earth by making reality a little more like fantasy. As you all know," Jimmy continued, "one of the few truly sacred rules we have is to never alter a living person's physical structure, because, of course, you will most likely kill them. However, a few of us have proven, mostly by accident, that if the change is made small enough, the subject can continue their life unharmed, and in some cases, unaware that anything happened to them at all. I have devised a plan whereby I can use small, incremental changes over a prolonged period of time to improve the physical condition of every man, woman, and child in this country."
Jimmy whipped the sheet off of the table, revealing a three-dimensional relief map of the British Isles. The cities were delineated by small, stylized models blown far out of scale to the land itself to make them stand out better. Camelot was a recognizable golden model of the castle, but most of the other cities, towns, and villages were less recognizable. Jimmy produced a pointer and indicated London, now Camelot, and most of the main island.
"In this area, people will remain largely unchanged. I have a plan to make them a bit taller, more muscular, and overall healthier, but there will be no drastic changes. This area will be the Kingdom of Man."
Jimmy pointed to a small area near the border with Scotland.
"As we all know, this area has many rather dense forests. I have chosen this area to be the Kingdom of the Elves. The people of this area will be much taller and thinner, with larger eyes. I can't make them take to the trees, but I plan to encourage them with financial incentives. I know the elves will be a bit too far away to enjoy on a regular basis,
But marble throughout the kingdom of man, there will be occasional pockets of hobbits to work the farmland and generally add local color. In the final phase, Scotland, being quite mountainous, will of course be home to the dwarves.
Jimmy lowered his pointer and radiated smugness while everyone else tried to fully comprehend everything he'd said. Finally, the thick, velvety silence was broken by Eddie.
Remember when I said that he tells me everything? I was mistaken.
Philip said,
So what happened at Rickard's Bend then, Something go wrong with your hobbits?
Jimmy sucked at his teeth, then said,
Yes, regrettably. My encounter with Tyler left me so shaken that I accidentally skipped a step in their transformation plan, and, well, y'all know what happened then. Anyway, it was a most unfortunate accident, and I certainly don't blame Tyler for it.
Martin rubbed his eyes and took a deep breath.
He doesn't understand, he thought. He honestly does not get how wrong he is.
Philip cleared his throat and finally, for the record, said,
Jimmy, you're a bastard.
Jimmy seemed more confused than insulted.
Is trying to improve life for everyone make me a bastard, Philip?
Yes,
Philip shouted.
If you don't give them any choice, it does.
Jimmy said,
Well, Philip, if you want to eat a hamburger, you have to kill a cow. If you want to make a chair, you have to kill a tree. I want elves and hobbits, and I haven't killed anyone to make them, deliberately. I do feel very bad about Rickard's Bend.
Good,
Philip said.
You should! But even if you hadn't killed an entire village, you'd still be wrong. What if all of these people you're helping don't want to be dwarves and elves, Did you ever think about that,
Jimmy rolled his eyes as if he thought Philip was being terribly silly.
Philip, of course they won't want to become mythological creatures at first. Change is always scary. Once they see what they've gained, they'll change their minds. When the dwarves start pulling up all that gold that I'll keep magically feeding into their minds, when the hobbits find out that life in Hobbiton is like a perpetual Oktoberfest held in Amsterdam, when the elves start to notice that they have a lifespan of hundreds of years, though actually I'll probably have to tell them about that up front. The point is, they're all getting something in return.
But they weren't given a choice,
Philip said.
You took that upon yourself, and you chose to murder over 100 people and endangered... Well, I'm not sure. How many people have you endangered?
Jimmy thought.
If you're referring to the experimental villages I've modified as a proof of concept, there are two more. That brings me to the next point. When Tyler reacted so badly to my hobbit village, I knew I needed to speed up certain parts of the process so I could really show you what I'm trying to do. Look... I know you're planning to exile me and cut me off. I have the right to a proper defense. All I ask is that y'all come with me and let me show you my work. I promise, you won't regret it.
Jimmy took his staff in hand, lifting it so the glowing blue plasma ball was slightly above head height, and offered his shoulder to Philip. Philip grimaced, then put a hand on Jimmy's shoulder. Jimmy looked to Martin, who followed suit, and in a moment, everyone in the room was linked. Jimmy said,
Regardless of how this all comes out, I want to thank all of you for trusting me, huh? Transporto al Arimio post alpha!
As soon as they heard that, every wizard in the room regretted having trusted Jimmy. The wizards appeared in an empty field just outside Camelot's fortified golden walls. The sky was still bright and clear. The sun was still blindingly bright, reflecting off of the golden city wall, which they were facing. Behind them was about a half mile of open field with forest on the far edge. Between them and the wall were at least 500 soldiers. They were standing at attention, wearing golden chainmail, rows and columns of them stretching off to both sides and back into the distance until the last row of soldiers stood with their backs to the wall. They were all quite tall, and their skin had an ashy blue pallor. Jimmy took a single graceful step that covered the 40 or so feet between the wizards and the soldiers, He landed lightly and spun theatrically, his arms stretched wide. His green and gold robe swirled around him. He waved his staff over the heads of the soldiers with a flourish.
"Feast your eyes upon the king's fearsome army of orcs!"
Jimmy bellowed in triumph. The various wizards said various things under their breath, but Philip summed up their feelings with a single word.
"Crap!"
Jimmy spun around again to look at his handiwork, turning his back to the wizards.
"I know, right?"
he said, putting his left hand on his hip and leaning heavily on his staff.
"That chainmail is real gold, you know. Took me forever to produce all those little gold rings."
Martin was straining to process the full meaning of everything he saw. Some part of his mind gave up and decided to just take all of the problems one at a time. He was a bit surprised to hear himself yell,
"You can't make armor out of gold! It's too soft! An axe will go right through it!"
Jimmy looked back over his shoulder at Martin, and for a moment he looked concerned. Then he shrugged and said,
"Ah, oh well, I can always make more."
Gwen asked,
"More gold rings or more soldiers?"
"Either,"
Jimmy answered.
"And please, call them orcs."
"No, never! They're not orcs, they're not!"
Philip shouted.
"Well, not yet. To be honest, they're only about 10% of the way to their final form. I don't dare change them any faster."
Philip motioned to the soldier nearest to him.
"Yo, step forward."
The soldier lumbered forward. He was at least a foot taller than Jimmy, and his movements were slow and deliberate.
"They're still adjusting to their new size,"
Jimmy explained.
"Show me your teeth."
The soldier bared his teeth, large slabs of yellowed calcium with livid red gums, and more than a little blood gathered in the spaces between the teeth.
"It's quite painful, unfortunately. Not just because of the growth, either. As they get used to their new teeth, I'm afraid their cheeks and tongues take quite a bit of abuse. I deaden their pain receptors to compensate. As an added bonus, they know that if I'm unhappy, the pain comes back." Keeps them obedient.
Jimmy turned back to face the wizards, spreading his arms wide.
"Well, what do you think?"
Philip said,
"It's inhuman."
Jimmy said,
"Yes."
"No,"
Philip said.
Jimmy, this is inhuman. This is the worst thing ever. Even I didn't think you were capable of this. Jimmy, you have to stop. You have to change them all back."
"Oh, Philip, I can't do that. If I did, all my hard work would be wasted."
Philip didn't shout, but his voice had a hint of madness to it.
"Jimmy, you will undo everything you've done, and then we will decide on your punishment."
"And if I don't?"
Jimmy asked.
"Then we will undo what you've done and punish you."
Jimmy shook his head.
"That's not much of a choice. Eh, but you never were a very good negotiator, were you, Philip?"
He chuckled, but when it was clear that he was the only one who saw anything funny, he stopped. He took a long moment to gauge the mood of the wizards, who stood as a unified block behind Philip.
"Okay, I'll tell you what. If any of you agree with Philip, stay there with him. If you understand what I've done and see that it was the right way forward, then come stand with me."
Nobody, not even Eddie, moved to stand with Jimmy.
"I see,"
he said.
"All righty then, Philip. If what I've done is a terrible crime for which I must be punished, then I suggest you get on with it."
He laid his staff on the ground and crossed his arms in front of himself, as if waiting patiently for a police officer to handcuff him. Philip walked forward. He removed his hat and muttered,
"Schnuro gvar mitroin,"
to produce some rope. As he reached into his hat, he said,
"Well, Jimmy, I won't pretend that I'm not going to enjoy this."
Philip reached his hand into his hat and grasped, but got nothing but a handful of air. He tried a couple more times, perplexed. He was puzzling over this when he walked face first into the invisible exclusion field between him and Jimmy. Philip bounced off of the wall, sprawling backwards onto the grass, yelping with surprise. Jimmy said,
"I must admit, I enjoyed that quite a bit as well."
He bent down and picked his staff back up. Martin and Gwen ran to Philip's side as he lay on the ground 5 feet in front of where Jimmy stood. Philip sat up, feeling his nose to see if it was broken. Jimmy said,
"You'll find that the entire city of Camelot is surrounded by an exclusion field, the largest ever attempted. That's what I had to rush to get finished when Tyler turned out to be such a wuss." You're gonna love this part. The magic phrase that activated it was, "Alrighty then, Philip." You see, I always knew you'd turn on me someday.
"I turned on you years ago,"
Philip cried from his seated position on the ground.
"You think I didn't know that? You didn't hide your hostility very well, Philip."
"I didn't hide it at all. I've been openly hostile."
"Well,"
Jimmy sniffed,
"don't think for 1 minute that I was fooled by your false friendship."
"I hate you! I hate you! I've hated you openly for years!"
"And finally, the truth comes out."
Philip shouted inarticulately for a while, too mad to care that he was giving Jimmy just what he wanted. Finally, he stopped and hoisted himself to his feet, picking up his staff and hat.
"You won't be needing those,"
Jimmy said.
"I've disabled the shell on that side of the field. If any of you had come over to stand with me, you'd still have your powers and full access to the shell. But instead, you're cut off. The shell will ignore you as long as you're out there. So, pretty much for the rest of your lives."
Martin shouted,
"You won't get away with this, Jimmy!" "I've already gotten away with it. It just took you cretins this long to notice. And my name is Merlin!"
Jimmy composed himself, then continued,
"Of course, since the shell doesn't work at all out there, I can't use magic against you either."
None of the wizards on the wrong side of the barrier were surprised when Jimmy continued,
"So, I'll just have to sick my orcs on you instead."
Philip was in a full rage.
"They aren't orcs, you idiot! Just because you call something something doesn't make it it!"
Jimmy shook his head.
"Oh, Philip, you've always lacked imagination, as that last sentence proved."